Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, From Death to Life, we share a moving testimony from a former supervisor of executions at a US prison, who describes how this experience led him to become an anti-death penalty activist. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. We begin today's programme with a moving story from a leading anti-death penalty activist in the US and Catholic convert, whose views changed after he had to supervise executions in a Florida prison. Today, the United States is the only Western democratic nation that imposes the death penalty on its citizens. But while around 2 out of 3 Americans currently support capital punishment in cases where a person is convicted of murder, there has been a sharp fall in the number of death sentences handed down and in the number of executions eventually carried out. Figures show that the execution rate in the US is around 50% lower compared to the late 1990s. One reason is that state governors, who have the final say on this matter, are more willing to grant clemency where there is any doubt. Another reason for shifting attitudes is the use of more advanced DNA testing, a procedure which has led to scores of death row prisoners being acquitted. One of the US's leading campaigners against the death penalty is Ron McAndrew, who grew up as a strong supporter of capital punishment. McAndrew's views on the death penalty changed dramatically after he served as director of the state prison in Florida, where his job included supervising executions of those on death row. He began by telling us why the death penalty fails to act as a deterrent and reduce levels of violent crime in his country.
I believe that the death penalty increases murders. We know this from the European example, where you do not have the death penalty and you have much less murders than you do in the United States. The death penalty is not a deterrent to murder. It is not a deterrent to any form of crime. It is simply a barbaric politician's tool.
McAndrew went on to explain why he supported the death penalty when younger, and that's why he ended up taking the job as director, or warden, of the state prison in Florida in 1996.
I grew up in a conservative, very rural country area of North Carolina. I was raised by conservative grandparents who supported the death penalty like everybody else in our community. It was just a very natural thing to support. If you kill someone, you should be killed. I mean, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The biblical quote was quoted constantly. I found myself one day being asked to go to Florida State Prison as the new warden in 1996. The secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections, Mr. Harry K. Singletary Jr., called me on the phone and said, "Ron, I would like for you to take over Florida State Prison. I'd like for you to be the warden there. It's an enormous responsibility." He said, "I need someone who's very strong and can handle that place. But I have one question I must ask you. Will you have any problems," he said, "carrying out the death penalty?" And my response was very quick and very sure. I said, "No, sir."
But very quickly after starting his new job at this prison, McAndrew told us how the first seeds of doubt about the justice of the death penalty were planted in his mind.
I started practicing with the death team on carrying out the death penalty. But a few things started happening that I had not counted on. I never realized that I would be the person to meet the family of the condemned and also the family and friends of the victim. or at least the alleged victim. I found myself reading the investigation that had sent this man to death row. As a past investigator, having investigated hundreds of crimes, including murder, I found the investigation rather weak, and I couldn't understand how a jury could have sent this particular individual to death row. I asked an attorney friend who worked in this field, and he told me, "Ron, don't read that." He said, it'll only mess up your mind, because he said, quite frankly, there's no justice in our courts in terms of the death penalty. He said, it's simply a question of which attorney is the best actor and the best convincing attorney in terms of telling the jury their side of the story.
As McAndrew went on to explain, it was precisely the close contact he had with the families of both the condemned and of the murder victim that provided him with his first moral awakening.
First execution, my first moral shock. I found the mother and two sisters of the condemned waiting to see me outside of my office one morning. And I had a policy of seeing everyone, so I invited them into my office. And I sat across from these three women, and I could tell that they were horribly distressed because someone that they loved very much was about to be killed, purposefully killed. We have some questions, and will I be able to see my brother? The sister told me, and I said, of course, and I said, I'll bend the rules as much as I can to allow you to visit as often as possible. But when the mother looked me straight in the eye, with tears streaming down her face, and she said, "Warden, I just have one question. Will I be able to hug my baby before y'all kill him?" That hit me like a ton of bricks. She left me with an uneasy feeling. I felt my conscience crawling right up my back. I found myself getting to know the prisoner, the condemned. I saw him at his cell every day. I carried messages from his attorney. I realized suddenly that this was not so mechanical. It was not so administrative. It was getting very personal. I then had the sister of the victim, who was very angry and full of hate, and she was looking for revenge. She asked me, she said, "Warden, I want to go to that execution." I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll approve that." She said, "I want a front row seat. I want to sit right in front of the electric chair. I want to watch this man burn to death."
He shares with us his memories of what happened on the day of the first execution he was in charge of supervising in the Florida State Prison.
The morning of the execution, I thought it would be very automatic, very easy. I went to the death cell. I sat on the bed next to the inmate, and I told him, I said, "I hate to do this, but the law requires me to." I said, "I have to read you your death warrant." I just said, "It's signed by the governor and by the attorney general." And I started reading, and it's a rather long document. And I started reading this, and about halfway through the death warrant, the prisoner who was handcuffed and sitting next to me, he could tell I was having a hard time getting the words out. And he sort of elbowed me a little bit with his left elbow. He said, "It's okay, Warden. I'm ready." He said, "I've made my peace with God. Here, I'm about to kill him, and he's trying to make it easy for me." It told me very quickly which of us was the strongest, because I didn't have that kind of nerve. But I took this man into the death chamber. I put him to death. I watched the family member of the victim stare with hate all across her face throughout the execution, with her arms crossed, very angry look, and the condemned was concentrating so strongly on his final prayer that I don't think he even noticed her. I don't think he noticed any of the witnesses.
One of the most pivotal and most shocking executions he witnessed at the Florida State Prison came when, due to a malfunction, flames shot out from the face and head of the condemned man when the electrical current was applied to him in the electric chair. The prisoner in question at that botched execution was a Cuban refugee called Pedro Medina. McAndrew told us more about that gruesome incident in which he saw Medina literally being burnt alive.
This man had no education. He had serious mental problems. He certainly did not know how to interact socially any place with anyone. He had lived a wild life on the streets and a wild life in prisons. He needed psychological help more than anything else. But I went through the same process, took Pedro Medina into the death chamber. I remember watching the engineer remove the sponge from the saline solution and squeeze it before he put it on Pedro Medina's head just before the execution. And I questioned the amount of water he had squeezed out of the sponge. But the chief electrician said it was fine. Everything's fine, he said. So when I gave the order to the executioner to turn on the electricity, there was an immediate fire. A flame dipped down out of a copper helmet on Pedro Medina's head and came straight up in front of my face. His head was on fire. I was aghast. So was everybody else. The electrician, who was wearing the big heavy gloves and had the capability of removing the helmet, asked me if we should continue. There's no way I could stop. I told him to continue. I walked out of that death chamber that day knowing that I had personally helped burn a human being to death, burn him to death. I hoped, but somehow in the back of my mind, I still supported the death penalty. And today I can't understand why, but I did. The governor was very angry about the fire. He actually fired me and rehired me in the same day and then ordered me to go to Texas and to learn how to do lethal injections. So I went to Huntsville, Texas, and I worked with the death team there for 5 lethal injections. I brought all of this knowledge back to Florida, purchased all of the equipment, and got Florida prepared for the new way of killing people who had possibly killed other people.
But it wasn't just that botched execution that was causing McAndrew to grow increasingly uneasy about the use of the death penalty. He says cases involving the wrongful convictions of a number of men on death row often kept him awake at night.
Sometimes people are wrongfully convicted. I had an experience that keeps me awake at nights. I went to speak in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania about 2 years ago, and I was one of the guest speakers there, and I was walking down the hallway of the large hotel where we were all staying. And I saw a man standing there in the middle of the foyer, and he looked familiar to me. And I saw him look at me, and he opened his arms up, and he wrapped his arms around me, and he gave me a big hug. That was Mr. Juan Melendez. The last time I had seen Melendez was he was in a prison cell at Florida State Prison, and he was on death row. He was found innocent and removed. When I laid down in my bed that night and I tried to close my eyes, I had this vision of me taking Juan into the death chamber and putting him in the electric chair and killing him. And there he's totally innocent of all crimes. He's a wonderful man who should never have gone to prison, but he had a crooked sheriff who was running for election. He needed to catch somebody doing a big crime to get his name in the newspapers. So the sheriff succeeded in what he wanted to do. And this poor man who had come to Florida from Puerto Rico found himself sitting on Florida's death row for 20 years. What a horrible thing to happen.
McAndrew told us he prays just as hard for murder victims as he does for the condemned prisoner. And as he goes on to explain, there are special reasons for that.
There's murder in my own family. My sister-in-law, Linda McAndrew, was murdered in Charlotte, North Carolina in the year 1990. We miss her very much. She was a precious part of our family. She was killed by a horrible man who later committed suicide in prison himself. Today, I find myself praying for him just as I pray for my sister-in-law, because that's the right thing to do. That's the moral thing to do.
McAndrew asked for and gained a transfer away from the state prison in Florida to one in Orlando and started to examine his conscience more and more deeply until one day he realized that he could no longer support the death penalty.
I really did some very serious soul searching about why we were killing people who had possibly killed other people to show our children that killing was the right thing to do, or more appropriately, the wrong thing to do. I had been attending Mass for a long time with my wife, more to please her than to please God. But I found myself at a Mass shortly after that, and as we prayed, something I normally didn't do, I found myself asking God to forgive me for ever having taken part in the death penalty or for having ever supported it. And I knew that day that there was no way on God's good earth that I could ever ever again support the death penalty.
Since that pivotal day in his life, McAndrew has become one of the leading activists against the death penalty in the US and now lectures and campaigns against it throughout the nation. And it wasn't by chance that his change of view on capital punishment coincided with his decision to join the Catholic Church.
The death penalty in the United States is there for one reason and one reason only. It's a political tool. Politicians know that statistics show that approximately 70% of Americans support the death penalty, just as I did, and probably for the same reasons that I did, simply because it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and they've been told since they were little kids that this is the right thing to do. So if a politician looks at these figures, he says to himself, well, am I going to go for 30% of the votes or am I going to go for 70% of the votes? If I'm asked if I support the death penalty, I'm going for 70%. So even politicians that I've known in the past who are Catholic men who should not be supporting the death penalty because they know that the church tells them that it's wrong, they still do. I can tell you that this process that I went through in terms of examining my conscience and going to Mass, I was not a Catholic man. I simply attended Mass because my wife is a lifelong Catholic. But through this process, I found myself sitting with a priest. I thought I could just walk into his office and say, Father Joe, I'd like to become a Catholic. Can you sign me up? And I found out it wasn't that easy. I had to go to catechism, in fact, for a year and a half. And then on one beautiful Easter day, I became a Roman Catholic and a very proud one. And my faith has grown every year since.
I was speaking to Ron McAndrew, a leading campaigner against the death penalty in the U.S. And now our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, gives us a roundup of the past week's events here in the Vatican. Okay, Joan, let's go back over this past week in the Vatican.
An exciting and a busy week. And, you know, if we only had time for one story, the one I would tell is the fact that former director of Vatican Radio and the Holy See Press Office, Father Federico Lombardi, you heard him for years, folks, Wednesday evening he received France's highest order, the Légion d'honneur. And this was in recognition, as we all know, of a career devoted to communicating the message of the Holy See. And also for his great attention to the French language, especially through, obviously, the airwaves of Vatican Radio. And in receiving the award, Father Lombardi underlined the importance of circulating the Pope's message in the media. And he also praised the coverage of international news by the media of the Holy See, said this was an indispensable condition for understanding the main concerns of the Church, which of course it is.
Okay.
A great story. That was middle of the week, but we go back to Sunday, because Sunday was interesting.
Yes, Sunday was. Go ahead, Joan.
The Holy Father, on Sunday afternoon, paid a visit to a parish, Maria Josepha of the Heart of Jesus. This is in the suburbs of Rome. And he spoke to the parishioners and met with a group of children, and then he celebrated Mass. And his basic message was telling the congregation never to go down the road of revenge or resentment. He said, pray for those who want to do evil. This prevents wars and brings peace. And by the way, folks, this is also the Christian path to holiness. What I loved afterwards, the kids were asking him some questions, and he had a nice give and take with students the previous Friday, just, you know, asking interesting questions.
They were asking about...
Yeah, they asked how he got elected. One of the little kids said, so how did you get elected? And he said, well, you know, there's this group of men called the Cardinals, the College of Cardinals, and he said, by the way, I want you to know they don't always pick the smartest person as the Pope. He said the chosen pontiff perhaps isn't the most intelligent, the shrewdest, the quickest, but he is the one God wants for that moment for the Church. So you just kind of kind of want to sit around with the little kids in moments like this and watch their expressions as they listen to the Pope. So,
and a great answer.
Yeah, exactly. A wonderful, wonderful answer. And Monday, fairly quiet, but Tuesday we had which is normally the quiet day as the Pope prepares the Wednesday general audience. But on Tuesday, Pope Francis did greet participants of a two-day international forum on migration and peace. And he said the challenges of migration and the promotion of peace cannot be tackled without development and integration. And obviously, we know the Holy Father's concern for refugees, for migrants, and so forth. And it was kind of a lengthy talk. He did draw attention to especially vulnerable groups of migrants, and that is to say exiles and refugees and children and young people who are forced to live far from their homeland. And he said the political community, civil society, and the church must offer a shared response to the complexities of the phenomenon of migration today. Now, this two-day forum was organized by the Dicastery for Integral Human Development, a Vatican office, of course, and the Scalabrini, a religious order, the Scalabrini International Migration Network. So the Pope, in this very lengthy speech, did highlight, he said, our shared response may be articulated by four verbs: to welcome, protect, promote, and integrate. And then he went on at quite some time about each of those topics.
Okay, let's move on to Wednesday. That was a very busy day, not just the general audience.
Oh, it's like, did the Holy Father even have time for lunch? So before the general audience, in a small room next to the Paul VI hall, the Pope received 30 relatives of victims of an attack that took place in Dhaka, Bangladesh, last July. Then at the audience, of course, he had his usual catechesis, but he received different people and groups. He got a soccer jersey from an Italian group, and it had the words on it in Italian, "Let's give a kick to bullying." And that was on the front and Papa Francesco on the back of the shirt. And this was given to him by the director of a sporting club in Rome that's working very hard to eliminate, to fight bullying in sports and in schools and so forth. And then the Holy Father took a few seconds out to bless the Benedictine Torch of Peace. Now, since 1964, the year St. Benedict was named a patron of Europe, this Torch for Peace has been sponsored by the city of Norcia to promote unity and peace in Europe. Now, we said it's the Benedictine Torch, obviously Norcia, the home, the devastated home because of earthquakes now, the devastated home of St. Benedict and his sister, St. Scholastica. And in yet another individual meeting on Wednesday, Pope Francis met with members of the European Union Naval Force in the Mediterranean. And it's known as Operation Sophia, and they're tasked with stopping people from being smuggled across the Mediterranean. And they gave a kind of a plaque, a plate-like thing, to the Holy Father with the words of their mission on it. And then, as if all of this wasn't enough, plus, of course, his catechesis on Christian hope, the Holy Father greeted members of the Roni Roller Circus. There were acrobats from this circus who gave a brief presentation to the Holy Father at the end of the audience. So,
and even far eaters.
Yes. That was pretty amazing. You kind of look at the Holy Father's face and he's saying the same thing to himself we were. How does that man do that? And the Pope did speak off the cuff to them. He thanked them and he said, "You make something beautiful." And he talked about how important beauty was in life. And then, as I said, the Holy Father did return to the catechesis on hope, and he talked about creation. This was so interesting, linking creation and hope. And he said, rather than being something we possess and use for our own pleasure, he quoted St. Paul and said, St. Paul reminds us creation is God's gift, which reveals to us his loving plan. But when we are self-centered and commit sin, we break our communion with God and the original beauty of human nature and creation is marred. Thus, rather than show God's love, creation bears the wounds of human pride. But he says the Lord doesn't abandon us, but offers us a new horizon of freedom and salvation. So we still have hope. And he made an appeal and also mentioned Fatima. The Pope made an appeal for South Sudan at the end of the audience. He spoke of the painful news coming from suffering South Sudan, from this country where, he said, a fratricidal conflict is compounded by a severe food crisis. This has hit the Horn of Africa and condemns to death by starvation millions of people, including many children. And then the Holy Father also mentioned, because we are in the year of the centenary of the apparitions at Fatima, he did mention Fatima, and of course we know he will go there on pilgrimage May 12th then and 13th. Also, the Pope mentioned that Wednesday was February 22nd, which is the Feast of the Chair of Peter. And this is a wonderful day because the statue of Peter the Pope on the right-hand side of the main aisle is all dressed up in fine vestments and a papal tiara and a papal ring. And there's usually, throughout the day, on the altar of the Chair of Peter, there's usually like 100, 120 candles that are lit all day. So it's a wonderful feast day, and the Pope did mention that. And then actually an interesting press release came out from the Secretary of State on Wednesday detailing steps the Vatican is taking to protect the image of the Holy Father so that his message can reach the faithful intact and his person not be exploited. So the Secretary of State aims to protect the symbol and coats of arms of the Holy See through appropriate regulatory instruments provided for on an international level. They're going to affect systematic surveillance activities. Now, how this is going to be done, we don't really know, but I suppose if there's a breach of this surveillance, we will hear about it. So we're going to protect the image of the Holy Father, the coat of arms, etc.
Let's move on to Thursday.
The Pope received a group of Jewish leaders, including, of course, his longtime friend from his native Argentina, Rabbi Abraham Skorka. And the rabbi accompanied a delegation of Jewish leaders involved in a preparation of a new edition of the Torah. And they gave the Pope a copy of this beautiful edition. And he said the important religious figures who have worked on this new edition have paid special attention both to the literary aspect of the text and to the full-color illustrations that add further value to the publication. What was so interesting, too, in his remarks, the Pope spoke of the Torah as, quote, a building block of community, the worldwide Jewish community and the Christian community. And then he said, the Torah manifests the paternal and visceral love of God. So a very interesting meeting, especially between two friends of long standing. And then on Thursday, another very, very brief meeting, but the Holy Father met some members of the Spanish soccer team, Villarreal, and he said that in life, as in sport, it's the team spirit that is so vital in playing a good match on the field, of course, and a good match in life and society. Now, the players and staff were in Rome to play the AS Roma team, and this is part of a championship that all the teams are into.
And that match has already been played, actually, as we're taping this. And in fact, the Spanish team defeated AS Roma in their home stadium.
They did. Okay, I did not follow up on that. Thank you so much. Well, I think we have run out of time.
Yeah.
It happens a lot on this show, doesn't it?
Thank you so much, Joan.
See you next week.
See you then.
And I was speaking there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief. That's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.